Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, a Democrat, said today that he will not meet with Judge Amy Coney Barrett, the president's pick for the Supreme Court.
Looking ahead, tonight's the debate between the president and Joe Biden. As the New York Times continues to detail how President Trump paid some taxes, Social Security, Medicare, but avoided millions in federal income taxes. So what's the Republican strategy? Mark Lotter is Director of Strategic Communications for the Trump campaign. Mark, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, and as you know, many good Americans voted for Donald Trump in 2016 because they believed in his story that he was a hugely successful billionaire. And we see in the tax return reporting, he was actually a business failure who barely paid taxes because of his reported losses and is now swimming in debt, some to foreign countries, perhaps a security risk. Now, Joe Biden is likely to point out that any economic growth during the Trump years started in the Obama years. That trajectory is pretty clear. So what else does Donald Trump say to those voters tonight who feel they're not looking at the man they voted for? They're looking at, and this is the word that is coming up, they're looking at a fraud.
Well, I think that's just sheer nonsense. We have seen such economic gains under this president. There was just a Census Bureau report that showed American household income was at the highest level ever recorded in 2019.
But respond to the way he presented himself and this report about his taxes. He didn't pay any taxes for over a decade, and when he did, it was $750.
That's just simply not true. The president has paid millions of dollars in taxes over the years. You can just look around the world to see the success that he has built through his corporation.
The only way that Donald Trump can convince people who've seen the reporting on his tax returns on federal income taxes is if he shows his tax returns. Will he do that tonight?
You know, I'll just tell you, the president each and every year files a very detailed financial disclosure report. Meanwhile, the mainstream media ignores the fact that Joe Biden used the tax code to avoid paying $500,000 in taxes. He's also got very questionable financial dealings through his son getting a $3.5 million wire transfer from the wife of the mayor of Moscow.
Let's go there, Mark. You mentioned Joe Biden. We see his tax returns because he turned them in. And you mentioned Hunter Biden. And that gives me the indication that President Trump will bring up the fact that Hunter Biden had a seat on a board in Ukraine, very controversial, while his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, was charged with fighting corruption in Ukraine. But as you know, a Republican investigation just concluded that while that was awkward, there was no evidence that that made Joe Biden do anything but what he was supposed to do, which was fight corruption in Ukraine. There was no evidence of that. And if President Trump raises Hunter Biden tonight, doesn't Joe Biden then be allowed to come back with Ivanka Trump? Because, again, some of these findings show that she may have been paid a huge consulting fee while she was on the payroll of her father, something that is illegal, and that all the Trump children are involved in businesses that are benefiting from him being president.
The president has been very forthcoming with his finances. He reports it each and every year. People can look at that. They can also see that this is a president who is actually fighting for American jobs. While Joe Biden was the one who actually voted for NAFTA, which shipped our jobs overseas.
Let's take up the coronavirus. He played it down publicly while we now know he was telling Bob Woodward he knew how extremely serious COVID-19 was. He downplays life-saving masks. And we're also hearing today from Olivia Troy, a conservative Christian who was a top aide to Mike Pence, who quit because of what she calls pressure from Trump to distort facts about COVID-19, including most recently distort the data on kids and whether or not they can get sick so that Trump could say he got them back to school.
Well, first off, I would disagree with all of those comments. And this person from the vice president's office was a backbench, basically administrative functionary.
Olivia Troy was the top security aide to Mike Pence.
She was a low-level staffer, and the people who were actually in the meetings, which she supposedly says, don't ever remember her actually being there or hearing those same conversations. But it is absolutely the president's responsibility to make sure that our country remained calm. And while he was talking about keeping calm, he was mobilizing the largest private sector effort since World War II to manufacture protective gear, masks, ventilators.
Go to the present time. Just last week, the president said COVID-19 affects virtually nobody. There are over 200,000 families in the United States thinking that their loved ones is not a nobody. We've had more deaths in this country than any other. Is that a success?
We absolutely mourn everyone who has been lost because of it. But we are also making sure that we have got to keep the American economy moving, because all of the evidence shows that with the exception of those senior citizens, those who have high risk rates, they need to do everything they can to protect themselves. The rest of us got to get back out and experience life. 99.9% of America that gets this virus actually recovers from it.
Well, actually, the evidence shows that people can be very deadly and contagious even if they don't have symptoms, and they can be any age. You open the paper today, there's an obituary for a 29-year-old. So that's not true. Well, we also hear from President Trump how he plans on paying for pre-existing conditions when he wants to abolish the Affordable Care Act, and he has the Supreme Court nominee there to do it.
The president has already taken action to make sure that pre-existing conditions are covered.
How?
Through his executive order, and also to make sure that Americans have more access to private health care, expanding it through association plans. I know Joe Biden wants socialized medicine. He wants us all on government.
No, he doesn't.
Healthcare. But we'll have that debate, and the American people are going to see it for what it is tonight.
Mark Lauder, Director of Strategic Communications for the Trump campaign. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, quick follow. Joe Biden is not in favor of Medicare for all. He wants to expand and fix the Affordable Care Act. And that GOP Senate report did accuse a firm with links to Hunter Biden with receiving a payment from the Russian mayor's wife. But Biden's lawyer says he had no financial relationship with her.
All right, let's go now to Northern California, where the state's exhausting fire season grinds on with at least two more major fires erupting this week. In Shasta County, at least three people have died in the Zog Fire. And in Napa and Sonoma counties, the Glass Fire has scorched portions of wine country near Santa Rosa. It's reminding a lot of residents of the Tubbs Fire that killed 22 people in 2017. It was a traumatic event that prompted some families, as the Los Angeles Times is reporting today, to purchase things like fire-resistant straws to have on hand in case they needed to jump into the pool to survive. Kevin Stark is a reporter for KQED Science, and he's following these fires. Kevin, welcome.
Good afternoon.
And here we go again. What's the latest on these new fires, and what do we know today?
Well, so on Sunday night and into Monday, the Glass Fire, which is near where I am, erupted. It was driven by these dry winds. It was coming off of a heat wave over the weekend, and the fire just pushed across Napa Valley. At one point, it burned about 4 miles of coastal mountains in just 6 hours. You know, this has really been a wind-driven fire. Fortunately, last night, the winds broke, and yesterday, we got some cooler weather. That's giving firefighters a bit of an edge as they try and increase containment on this fire. Right now, it's burned about 42,000 acres. It is not contained. There's no containment and has destroyed more than 100 homes. Fortunately, there are no reported casualties on this fire right now.
And you were out in the field last night near Santa Rosa visiting evacuation shelters. What did you find there?
Yeah, I mean, you can just see how the pandemic has completely disrupted the typical evacuation support. So normally people would be fleeing to huge evacuation centers at fairgrounds and community centers. Right now, it's because of the coronavirus and the need to have social distancing, we have sort of set up evacuation pit stops. I'm at one right now. You know, there's places for people to check in. They get screened for coronavirus symptoms, and then they get funneled into hotels, into college dorms. There's places for them to camp. And then, honestly, a lot of people are just sleeping in RVs and campers and in their cars. You know, it can be pretty difficult to find a hotel room right now.
Well, and this is so tough because, as we said, many people were just starting to rebuild from the Tubbs Fire. 22 people died in 2017. How are people there processing that? And are some people facing the potential of losing their home for a second time?
Yeah, I mean, so this part of Northern California has just burned again and again. The Glass Fire actually pushed right up into an area where the Tubbs Fire had burned. So the same neighborhoods are being evacuated. And it just seems like it happens every year now. Last year, the biggest fire we had, the Kincade Fire, evacuated some of these same areas. And you might remember, last month we had this lightning storm that swept across the state and sparked some of the largest wildfires in state history. Well, one of those fires is right in this area as well. So I think people just feel a sense of exhaustion and fatigue, and they're just sort of beleaguered by what seems like a never-ending amount of fire.
Many of the acres burned are wineries, of course, critical to the area's economy. What would the impact be for that industry already hurting because of the pandemic, just briefly?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much to talk about there. I think the good thing about vineyards in moments like this is they're irrigated, so they often serve as fire breaks. This fire was so hot on Sunday night that actually burned into vineyards, destroying people's livelihoods. This fire is coming right at a time when the harvest is happening, and it's already been disrupted once. So I think this region is going to feel the impact of these fires through the disruptions. I just think it's a concern.
Kevin Stark with KQED Science. Kevin, thanks for your reporting. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
And we're hearing new details today about that grand jury proceeding that resulted in no charges against two officers for fatally shooting Breonna Taylor in Louisville. A member of the grand jury filed a court motion asking for permission to speak publicly about the proceedings and demanding that a transcript of the grand jury proceedings be made public, saying Kentucky's attorney general mischaracterized the proceedings and that jurors were never given the option of indicting the officers. Jess Clark is covering the story for member station WFPL in Louisville. Jess, tell us more about what this unnamed juror is saying about how Kentucky's attorney general mischaracterized what the jury concluded.
So the juror is calling on the court to order Attorney General Daniel Cameron to release the records and the transcripts from those proceedings and allow the jurors to speak publicly about those proceedings. And to remind you, the outcome, jurors brought charges against one of the three officers who conducted a raid on Breonna Taylor's apartment. And those charges were for wanton endangerment of Taylor's neighbors, and no one has been charged directly in her death. So what we don't know is what information Cameron actually presented to the grand jury and what charges he ultimately recommended.
But this is pretty explosive. Sorry. I just want to jump in and say this unnamed juror is saying that while Cameron, the attorney general, said jurors agreed that the officers shot Breonna in self-defense after her boyfriend fired his own gun, not knowing they were police, she seems to be saying they did not and that they weren't given the option of indicting the officers.
Well, I think what the lawsuit is saying is that they want the information from the proceedings to come out. So they want the evidence that was presented to them to be available to the public as well. Cameron has really laid the responsibility of that charging decision at the feet of the jury, and has dodged questions about what charges he actually recommended. And so the juror, in so many words, is saying, well, we want that information to be public too. We want people to know what information was presented to us and how we made that decision.
Again, that mischaracterized is quite a word there. We'll find out if we see the transcripts how the jury members feel that the AG mischaracterized what they actually did. But how are people there in Louisville reacting?
I think that people really have an appetite for more information about this case. I mean, for 6 months, the community, the family, and journalists have been waiting for this decision to come from Cameron. Yeah. And I think a lot of people anticipated getting answers about what happened. And with the decision of this magnitude, people are really left scratching their heads.
Right. Jess Clark reported WFPL News in Louisville. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, now a book release that's eerily timely. Author Karen Russell's 2011 novel, Swamplandia, centered around an alligator wrestling theme park. Her short story, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves, is about feral girls. Vampires in the Lemon Grove, well, vampires. But her novella, Sleep Donation, tells the story of a terrible pandemic of fatal insomnia, a horrible slow death by sleep deprivation. People are being tested to see if they have the antidote, dreams that can be harvested by the company Slumber Corps to help others sleep. So there are testing sites, overwhelmed hospitals, eerie comparisons to today, except Karen Russell wrote this in 2014. At that time, no less than Stephen King said it had a dreamlike beauty and that parts of it gave me nightmares, and I'm case hardened. High praise from that horror writer. But after only 8 months, the online publisher closed. Now Sleep Donation is finally out in a new paperback version, and Karen Russell is here. How weird has it been to watch this coronavirus pandemic after you wrote about one of insomnia?
Very weird timing, Robin. And to be honest, I wish that there were not so many parallels. You know, I think I was imagining a different world, you know, when we were discussing this reissue. It's been such a vertiginous season, I think, for all of us that it's sort of hard to parse.
And it's so interesting because yours is all about dreams. And people have been reporting more vivid dreams. And you added some content at the end of this novella. It purports to be an alert from this company, Slumber Corps, active nightmare outbreaks in the U.S. It shows the map where the outbreaks are. I mean, it looks just like a CNN map of COVID-19. Some of the strains of dreams include wallpaper made of your poor report cards, surgeons snipping at the overgrown vines in your belly. Did you take any of this added material from COVID-19 dreams?
No, you know, I didn't. I was really excited to have something that felt sort of like a whimsical riff on those CDC brochures. You know, it seemed funnier, I think, to me a year ago. Now we're living through such an unremittingly grim season. But I do sort of think there's a secondary epidemic of nightmares going around. I think we are all having these very vivid dreams. And at the time, I was working with these amazing Italian artists. We were going to come up with a nightmare contagion map with these sleep quarantine stations. You know, if you have a bad dream that recurs twice in a 72-hour period, you should report to your doctor and things like this. And so it was very strange when suddenly our emails sort of morphed overnight and they were saying, you know, we can't work on this right now. We're under lockdown ourselves. And suddenly we were all going to the CDC website for information instead of inspiration. And so it's been a very strange experience.
Where did this inspiration come from? The New York Times says the kernel was Gabriel Garcia Marquez's 100 Years of Solitude.
You know, I'm sure that insomnia plague in Macondo imprinted deeply on me. It's so beautiful if people haven't read it. But I was also thinking about Jonathan Swift's A Modest Proposal, because at some point I thought this was going to be a satirical take on the ravages of our economy. And there's a little baby in this story, Baby A. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court rules that babies and children can give donations of sleep to these, you know, sleep-starved Americans. And it just didn't seem a bridge too far to imagine a scenario like that. I feel like it sort of literalizes something that's already happening in our economy to just steal the literal dreams of children.
Well, here's how you describe the horrors when it becomes fatal. Hundreds of our neighbors, friends, coworkers, and teachers are new insomniacs. You could substitute, you know, have COVID-19. They file for dream bankruptcy, appeal for Slumber Corps aid, that's the company, wait to be approved for a sleep donor. It's a special kind of homelessness, says our mayor, to be evicted from your dreams. So you have people being evicted, except not from their homes, from their dreams. You know, really quite something how closely connected it is. You have a main character, Trish, who describes, by the way, the donated dreams. She works for the company that takes the donation. She describes them as having a clay odor. Kind of felt to me, it's almost like a swampy thing that happens when dreams start.
I think I was picturing something like that, like if you've ever smelled like a lake at night, or, you know, that, you know, lily pad odor, sort of a mineral clay smell.
But she starts to have these ethical questions. She's been using the story of her sister who died to kind of lure dream donors in. She has questions about that, questions about using the baby. Mm-hmm. And by the way, the baby is in the family called Harkonnen. Our ace producer here wants to know, is that a reference to the big science fiction novel Dune?
It is. This was sort of my first attempt to write science fiction. You know, I'm a near future dystopia, and I think Dune was a book that was so seminal for me. So that's a little wink to the other fantasy science fiction readers out there. I was really interested in those questions about, is it possible to give a gift? You know, what are the conditions where a gift is freely given, and what is the line between a gift and something that's coerced? And for this woman in particular, I think it's interesting to come back to it, you know, in the emergency lighting of 2020, when our faith in institutions, you know, is so eroded. And she is working for a nonprofit. And the implication is that it may be very soon that sleep becomes a commodity. Her great fear is that perhaps we're going to see new global markets emerging, you know, created by these crises, and that this is just going to accelerate a kind of inequality where there's going to be, a nation of haves and have-nots. Only the have will be people who can rest and dream, you know, and people who are just sort of wandering the night. That doesn't seem so far off to me than the world we're really living in right now.
Well, there's a third category, people who are petrified to fall asleep, because there's another storyline here, a donor who didn't disclose, let's just say, that they shouldn't donate. They didn't check off that they have horrible nightmares, and then their nightmares infected all the people who received the donation. So now you have people who can't sleep, the insomniacs, who are dying, and you have people trying to avoid these horrific dreams. You say dystopian, it's a pretty horrible world.
It's a pretty horrible world, and I feel like I really ran with that, the what if of this kind of goofy premise, into a darker landscape than I had maybe anticipated at the beginning. But I will say, you know, there are these night worlds that start to kind of crop up where people, some of them are elective insomniacs, they're infected with this nightmare that's so terrible that they give up sleep. And then some people, you know, they are insomniacs, and somehow they all converge in these, on the periphery of cities and in these night worlds that kind of hawk black market remedies. And, you know, I can only think now, you know, obviously of like hydrochloroquine or some of these other more dubious medicines that kind of snake oil salesmen are peddling for the coronavirus. But I thought of these places, certainly not as utopias, but it was those were the most fun, beautiful scenes for me to write, thinking about the way that people can meet in weakness, you know, and the kind of communities that can form and the solidarity that can come when you're really right on the edge. You know, that is a powerful bond, I think, between people sometimes. If you share a nightmare in the form of an illness.
Yeah. And of course, now we have long haulers, you know, people still suffering with COVID-19. Karen Russell's book, which she wrote 6 years ago, Sleep Donation, is out in paperback. Karen, thank you so much. And sweet dreams.
Oh, to you too. Only the sweet ones. Thank you.
Data from the Federal Reserve finds that Americans were in relatively good financial shape heading into the coronavirus pandemic. Household wealth rose by 18% from 2016 to 2019, the Trump administration. According to the Fed's survey of consumer finances released on Monday, the report is put out every 3 years. But despite those gains, the racial wealth gap barely budged. The average black family had less than 15% of the wealth of white families in 2019. Let's bring in Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure. Hi, Robin.
Hi there.
So the Fed found that median household income rose 5% in the 3 years leading up to the pandemic. Pretty great, considering how topsy-turvy the economy is now, right?
I mean, it's hard to remember, but coming out of the 08-09 financial crisis, we were riding the longest economic expansion in U.S. history. And, you know, the longer the rising tide, the more likely it is to lift even the smallest boats, is how I would put it metaphorically.
Mm. Yeah. And that was a very long, years of expansion, kind of an arc. But just stay with that. Could that, you know, relatively good footing before all heck broke loose help families bounce back?
You know, it's ancient history, I think, at this point. The pandemic has reset so many things. It's made job gains precarious. If you weren't laid off from a service sector job, you've probably been furloughed or had your hours cut. You might have had to tap your precarious savings, of which we see in this survey that families of color had such a paucity of to begin with.
Well, and the report also found the distribution of wealth between the lowest and highest narrowed slightly, but there's still huge gaps, and gaps among different racial groups. What's causing this?
It's a generational multiplier effect. Wealth, we know, begets more wealth. Growth in capital and investment assets, it's far outpaced blue-collar wage gains. So say your great-grandparents are sharecroppers or your grandparents are manual laborers versus, you know, you being one generation removed from business owners. So you're already two steps behind as a Black family in terms of inheritance, say a 529, wedding gifts. Even parents and grandparents helping with higher education costs, that's shown to correlate greatly to economic standing. So more than half of white families today hold equities versus a third of Black families and just a quarter of Hispanic families.
Yeah, and we just did a story recently, one of my favorites, on how Blacks historically have and now are still getting lower estimates on the value of their home, you know, which has to do with racial bias. And that's how you accumulate wealth as well. So this report comes after a summer of protests over police brutality and racism. How do you think this report will fit into this current moment?
You know, gosh, Ron, one stat just blew me away, and I think it's an important talking point. The median Black family in the under 35 age group holds just $600 in wealth versus more than $25,000 among similarly aged white families. So to say that's a yawning gap is an understatement. And so you often hear the Black Lives Matter community discuss the pernicious effect of racism over hundreds of years. Slavery helped so many white Americans build wealth that transferred generationally, and that only grew while Black families were left behind. So it's a difficult conversation in 2020 that gets into income redistribution, reparations. The gap, Robin, is so massive, especially after this latest financial crisis, that you're not just going to be able to earn your way out of it.
Yeah. Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure on a recent report on inequities in wealth. Robin, thank you so much.
Thank you.
The coronavirus pandemic has now claimed the lives of more than a million people around the globe. And as the human toll grows, we will continue to remember those who've died. That includes 76-year-old Shafkat Khan, who died from COVID-19 in April. He was a Pakistani immigrant who lived in Jersey City, New Jersey. His daughter, Sabila, joins us now. And Sabila, it has been nearly 6 months since your dad died, and I'm sure that you still think about him every day. Tell me about what made your dad who he was.
My father was an extraordinary man. He spent many years advocating for the rights of the immigrant communities here, particularly the Pakistani American community. He started a nonprofit in 2000 called Pakistanis for America with the intent of increasing voter registration amongst our community. And then in 2001, after 9/11 happened, he pivoted and started organizing panels that allowed the many diverse communities of our city to come together and talk beyond our differences. So he was very instrumental in helping our city heal. And I think a lot of his community service, particularly with the Pakistani immigrant community here, was informed by the fact that we ourselves were undocumented for over a decade after we moved to Jersey City in 1982. And I think that experience of living close to the edge without health insurance, toiling away 6 days a week as a general manager in a convenience store in Brooklyn, working 12 hours a day, I think that really inspired my father to help those who might not have had the access to cut through the red tape of bureaucracy.
And he got sick early in the pandemic. Can you tell me what happened? And did you know that it was that serious when he was hospitalized back in April?
So my father had Parkinson's disease, which he suffered from for 10 years. And he was in a rehab facility getting physical therapy for his Parkinson's. And the facility closed their doors on March 11th. So we found out, you know, long story short, we found out in a very roundabout way that a couple of the patients at the rehab facility had tested positive for COVID and that he was sick. The evening of April 6th, he was rushed to the ER because he was very congested. And the ER is three blocks away from us. And, you know, it's a special kind of torture when it was the height of the pandemic in the New York, New Jersey area. I could only imagine what kind of a war zone the ER was. My father was a big teddy bear when it came to hospitals. He hated hospitals. So the idea that he was there alone was just devastating for us. And his phone was lost. We couldn't call him. Even if we were able to call him, he couldn't speak to us. So it was just the most terrible 7 days that we spent as a family waiting for updates on him. And he was, we knew how serious it was. I remember when I found out that they were going to transport him to the ER, I collapsed. And I said to my husband, he's going to die. He's going to die. They can't take him to the hospital. He's going to die. But the time that he did spend in the hospital, his numbers were very, very stable until they weren't. His heart stopped the morning of April 14th. We got a phone call.
It sounds like also, I mean, this is what we learned so quickly about this disease is that our loved ones would die alone. And yep. It sounds like that's what you experienced as well.
Oh, yeah. And he wasn't on a ventilator. He was on a nasal cannula. So he was alert and he awake, I would imagine, for most of it. So the fact that he was alone and aware and probably knew that he would never see us again was... it's just something that will haunt me for the rest of my life. And then even after he died, we couldn't be with him. We couldn't give him up. We had to watch his burial live streamed. And I think the only small mercy in this entire experience was that we're Muslims. And in our religion, the dead have to be buried right away. And we were initially told that we wouldn't be able to bury him for at least 2 weeks, which obviously was like just another sort of trauma on top of a trauma. But then family stepped in and were able to move mountains, and he was buried the next day. Yeah.
Sabila, I'm so sorry that you had to go through this, and I thank you for speaking to us about such a difficult time. And I want to ask you how it has been since those 6 months. I'm sure, as I said before, that you think about your father every single day, and yet we are in such an uncertain time. We are all still isolated. The economy is terrible. The country is fighting over the response to this pandemic. Does the time we're in make it harder for you to heal?
Oh, 110%. I mean, you would hope that during a time as terrible as this, that the country would be able to get together, right? The only other sort of national catastrophe I have that I experienced that I can compare this to is 9/11, and the country did come together. There was honor and respect and sort of memorialization of the dead at that time. Those families suffered trauma too, but I'm sure that helped carry them through it. And for the COVID bereaved, we're living in a time where everything is so divided. There's so much hate. My father and that, you know, 200,000 plus death tally is a political talking point. And any way you see it, it's triggering for us. The news is triggering. That you have COVID deniers, that's triggering. Family and friends are triggering. Social media is triggering. There is no sense of normalcy that we as a community are returning to. And that makes grief very, very difficult. I've come to terms with the fact that I'm not going to be okay for a very, very long time. Grief, I'm sure, under any circumstances is difficult, but I have to believe that grief under these circumstances, it's trauma. We are a very traumatized community.
And now we've reached 1 million deaths around the world. And I see so many people who are tired of the restrictions, who are gathering in groups, who are starting to return to habits from before the pandemic. And I include myself in that group. What is your message to people after having gone through what you went through? What do you say to people?
This is real. Don't take any of this lightly. Don't take any of this for granted. I couldn't be with my father in his final days. it's okay if you don't attend a wedding. It's okay if you don't attend a birthday. I find it very offensive when people are going about their lives as if there isn't a pandemic. I just want people to take the science seriously. I want politicians to take the science seriously.
Before I let you go, can you share a memory of your dad that you're going to hold with you?
Oh, that's difficult. There's so many. My father was someone who was full of wisdom. And the one sort of conversation I keep on going back to now, especially in this day and age, is when I asked my father why he was so obsessed with the political process, the American political process in the 80s, because some of my earliest memories are of watching the news with my father, watching primaries and debates with my father. And this was, as I had said, this was really surprising to me later as an adult because we had spent so many years undocumented. And my father wasn't able to vote in a presidential election until 2000. So I asked him once why he was so obsessed with the political process. And he said to me that the political process of any nation impacts all of the people in that nation, documented or not. And that has really resonated with me, especially now. So I really, really hope that people do take this opportunity to vote. And if not for themselves, then for the families that can't vote, the many undocumented families and the over 200,000 people who can't vote today because they've lost their lives to this virus.
Sabila Khan of Jersey City, New Jersey, remembering her dad, Shafkat Khan, who died from COVID earlier this year. He was 76. Sabila, thank you so much for your time and telling your story.
Thank you. Thank you again for the opportunity.
The volume of mail-in ballots is expected to break records this election season as the pandemic has forced states to quickly expand their use of voting by mail. And the amount of misinformation and conspiracy theories about mail-in voting has also surged from both Democrats and Republicans. But a primary source of that misinformation? President Trump. The president did the same thing after the 2016 election, appointing a commission to study voter fraud that was disbanded because there was so little to investigate. Only four cases of voter fraud were reported in the weeks after that election. Adam Clark Estes joins us now for more. He's deputy editor of Recode. Hi, Adam.
Hi there.
So you took a deep dive into what's being said about voter fraud, again, of which there's very little, on social media. You looked at some research from the firm Zignal Labs. What did they find?
We reached out to Zignal Labs, actually asking them to find the most prominent conspiracy theories that people were talking about ahead of the election. And we sort of expected some of the classic ones about the deep state or about George Soros. But actually, voter fraud came out as one of the most popular ones. And you might not think of voter fraud as a conspiracy theory, because so often in the press lately, it's being talked about, especially by the president and his administration. In fact, voter fraud is almost non-existent in the history of national elections in the United States. And so it is a conspiracy theory. And so as the discussion about vote by mail really heats up, as people are trying to find out information about how to do that, they might also be coming across President Trump saying that vote by mail leads to voter fraud, which frankly is not true.
Well, and it's not just President Trump. You point out the right-wing site Natural News, banned by Facebook for spreading conspiracy theories, pushing the baseless claim on its network of websites that Democrats are using mail-in voting to skew the election in their favor. Former Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, the Republican, claimed in his Facebook post that Democrats were spreading what he called a fake postal controversy. By the way, talk about some of these fake post office beliefs.
Over the summer, we got a new postmaster general, a top Trump supporter named Louis DeJoy. And we saw soon thereafter that there were widespread delays in the mail. This was a very real thing, but it also led to a lot of speculation that the changes and the disruptions in the Postal Service were a part of an attempt to sabotage the mail ahead of an election in which we'd see a historic amount of mail-in voting. So that's the postal conspiracy that folks are talking about. But I think that what's happening there is a little bit different than President Trump saying that vote by mail is in and of itself fraudulent. There's no evidence for that. There's a lot of evidence that the mail did slow down over the summer.
Well, and also there, you know, there's real truth about the mail slowing down. And then there are conspiracy theories about a millionaire guy going around stealing post office boxes or something. I mean, it's all kind of crazy making. One that's making the rounds, that arsonists set the terrible wildfires on the West Coast to shut down highways to suppress Republican turnout. Just crazy, by the way. We should say officials out there say there is no left-wing arsonist running around in California. But these conspiracy theories are bipartisan, you found. And yet we don't want to do a false equivalency here, as you know, you've just differentiated. Democrats claim that Republicans will suppress votes, and they say they are seeing examples of that. Just this week, a judge upheld a Republican passed law in Iowa stopping county workers there from filling in missing information on ballots that they had in their databases, something they've historically done. And the Trump campaign in that state has already invalidated thousands of these ballot applications. So a lot of these real concerns are mixed in with the online conspiracy theories.
From talking to conspiracy theory experts, the issue that really stood out to me here is that a lot of people want to believe in conspiracy theories because they help them add order to their worldview. It helps them explain things that are difficult to explain. And I think that this year is a year when there's so much uncertainty. A lot of people are looking for ways to feel better or more certain about what's going to happen. What I do think is different about the lead up to the election in November is that we have a president who is actively pushing conspiracy theories to try to gain an edge in an election where he's terribly behind. No matter who wins, there's going to be a lot of argument over whether or not what happened was legitimate, and that happens with every election. But I think this time around, we're dealing with a situation that we couldn't have anticipated and have gone through before.
Well, the Department of Homeland Security has warned Russia is again amplifying misinformation in this campaign. Do we know if Russians are ginning up these conspiracy theories?
There have been reports of Facebook taking down Russian accounts or Chinese accounts, but frankly, we don't know that much about what's happening with disinformation campaigns from abroad because the Trump administration hasn't been investigating them. I think in this case, the real problem, to use the old horror movie trope, the call is coming from inside the house. The disinformation is being spread very well on its own, thanks to the Trump administration and a lot of those on the right.
Adam Clark Estes, a deputy editor of Recode, on the just blossoming of conspiracy theories online about voter fraud, which, again, historically barely exists. Adam, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.
President Trump and Joe Biden meet for the first debate amid rising COVID-19 numbers and new revelations about President Trump's financial situation. We'll review the debate next time, Here and Now.